Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser, continued. Cassette 6, side 2.
Mangus, she must be a strange woman to rule over men. Is she as beautiful as Sonciare?
Flashy, tactfully. Oh, dear me, no. About the same build, but nothing like as pretty. No woman is.
We were sitting among the ruins by now, and at this point he toppled slowly backwards and lay with his huge legs in the air, singing plaintively. God, he was drunk. But I must have been drunker, for presently he carried me home in one hand. I weighed about 14 stone then, and dropped me into my wiki-up, through the roof, not the door, unfortunately. But if my final memories of that celebration was confused, I'm clear about what he said earlier, and if it sounds like drunkard's babble, just remark some of the things that supposedly simple savage knew, along with all his fanciful notions.
He'd heard of Spanish and British colonial rule, and of the American Wars of 76 and 1812. He'd even somehow got wind of Britain's negotiations with the old Texas Republic before it joined the States in 46. At the same time, he'd no idea what Spain or Britain or the United States or even Texas really were. Damn it, he thought the whole white race was only 10,000 strong, and obviously imagined Queen Victoria living in a wiki-up somewhere over the hills. He probably thought the American troops he'd seen were some sort of tribal war party whom the Pash could wipe up whenever they chose. And yet he could already read with uncanny wisdom the minds of a white race he hardly knew. Their spirit tells them to spread their law. They believe their spirit is better than ours. Poor old Red Sleeves. Wasn't he right, just?
No, he wasn't an ordinary man. I knew him over several months and can say he had the highest type of that lucid Indian mind which can put the civilized logician to shame, yet whose very simplicity of wisdom has been the Redskin's downfall. He was a fine psychologist. You'll note he had weighed me for a rascal and fugitive on short acquaintance. An astute politician and a bloody, cruel, treacherous barbarian who'd have been a disgrace to the Stone Age. If that seems contradictory, well, Indians are contrary critters, and Apaches more than most. Mangus Colorado taught me that, and gave me my first insight into the Indian mind, which is such a singular mechanism, and so at odds with ours, that I must try to tell you about it here. Speaking of Apaches in particular, you must understand that to them deceit is a virtue. Lying, a fine art, theft and murder, a way of life, and torture, a delightful recreation. Ah, says you, here's old Flashy airing his prejudices, repeating ancient lies. By no means. I'm telling you what I learned at first hand. And remember, I'm a villain myself who knows the real article when he sees it. And the Pash are the only folk I've struck who truly believe that villainy is admirable. They haven't been brought up, you see, in a Christian religion that makes much of conscience and guilt. They reverence what we think of as evil. The bigger a rascal a man is, the more they respect him, which is why the likes of Mangas, whose duplicity and cunning were far more valued in the tribe than his fighting skill, and the Yawner, became great among them. This twisted morality is almost impossible for white folk to understand. They look for excuses and say the poor savage don't know right from wrong. Jack Cremony had the best answer to that. If you think an Apache can't tell right from wrong, wrong him and see what happens. At the same time, these Apaches, of whom there may be a few thousands at most, who live in some of the poorest land in the world, in the most primitive state, who are savage by nature, foul in habit, degraded of appearance, although some of their women are deuced handsome, who are backward and inferior in every outward respect, are nevertheless the most arrogant and self-satisfied people on God's earth. Their conceit makes the Chinese look modest. They don't merely pretend or think they're superior, they know it, like Lord Cardigan.
The hatred which they feel towards all other folk springs from no sense of jealousy or fear or unworthiness. On the contrary, they truly despise white civilization and want none of it, because they know absolutely that their own prehistoric ways are better. They hold the world in contempt as prey to be lived off. In some respects, you see, they're not unlike Britons or Americans. Now, this ingrained redskin conceit, for other tribes had it too, if not as extremely as the Pash, is something the American government has never understood and probably never will. And it's been at the root of the whole Indian question. I don't blame Washington. What civilized white, with his electric and gaslight and huge cities and flying machines, and centuries of art and literature and progress, could believe that this smelly, wicked, illiterate savage, who looks like a cross between a Mongol and an ape, absolutely thinks he is superior to them? It flies in the face of civilized reason, but not of Indian reason. They know they're better, and no demonstration or comparison will change their minds, you see, because their whole system of thought and philosophy is upside down from ours. You could take my old pal the Yawner and show him Paris or London, and it still wouldn't convince him. He'd say, "Huh, you can build great things and we cannot, but are they worth building? You can fly, but who needs to fly? I'd rather have my wiki up." And it wouldn't be sour grapes. The proud, stubborn, dear old bastard would rather have that wretched, stinking, flea-ridden hovel. Lord, I itch just to think of it. But I've been less hospitably used, mind you, and felt less honoured, in some ducal mansions. You see, it's been the great illusion of our civilization that when the poor heathen saw our steamships and elections and drains and bottled beer, he'd realize what a benighted ass he'd been and come into the fold. But he don't. Oh, he'll take what he fancies and can use, cheap booze and rifles, for example, but not on that account will he think we're better. He knows different. You begin to understand, perhaps, the impossibility of red man and white man ever understanding each other. Not that it would have made a damn bit of difference if they had, or altered the Yankees' Indian policy, except possibly in the direction of wiping up such intractable bastards even faster than they did. They knew they were going to have to dispossess the Redskins, but being good Christian humbugs, they kept trying to bully and cajole them into accepting the theft gracefully, which ain't quite the best position from which to make treaties with unreliable savages who are accustomed to rob rather than be robbed, and who don't understand what government and responsibility and authority mean anyway. You can't treat sensibly with a chief whose braves don't feel obliged to obey him. Contrariwise, if you're an Indian, worse luck, there's no point in treating with a government which is eventually going to pinch your hunting grounds to accommodate the white migration it can't control. And it doesn't help when the two sides regard each other respectively as greedy, brutal white thieves and beastly, treacherous red vermin. I'm not saying either was wrong. The Indian's tragedy was that being a spoiled and arrogant savage who wouldn't lie down, and a brave and expert fighter who happened to be quite useless at war, he could only be suppressed with a brutality that often matched his own. It was the reservation or the grave. There was no other way. My little anthropologist would say it was all the white man's fault for intruding. No doubt. But by that logic, Ur of the Chaldees would be a damn crowded place by now. The morning after Mangas's Tiswin party, I was rousted out at dawn by a foul-tempered Yawner, who took me miles off into the hills, both with our heads splitting, to prepare for my honeymoon. We must find a pretty secluded spot, he snarled, and build a bower for my bride's reception. We lit on a little pine grove by a brook, and there we built a wiki up. Or rather, he did while I got in the way and made helpful suggestions, and he damned the day he'd ever seen me, and stored it with food and blankets and cooking gear. When it was done, he glared at it, and then muttered that it would be none the worse for a bit of garden. He'd made one for Alipay, apparently, and she thought highly of it. So now I sweated, carefully transplanting flowers from the surrounding woods, while the yawner squinted and frowned and stood back considering. When I'd bedded them around the wiki up to his satisfaction, he came to give them a final pat and smooth, growling at me to go easy with the water. We got it looking mighty pretty between us, and when I said Sonsier Rage would be sure to like it, he shrugged and grunted, and we found ourselves grinning at each other across the flower bed. Odd, that's how I remember him. Not as the old man I saw last year, but as the ugly, bow-legged young brave, all Apache from boots to headband. So serious as he arranged the blooms, just so, cleaning the earth from his knife, and looking sour and pleased among his flowers. A strange memory in the light of history, but then he's still a yawner to me, for all that the world has learned to call him Geronimo. The wedding took place 2 days later, on the open space before the old fort at Santa Rita, and if my memories of the ceremony itself are fairly vague, it's perhaps because the preliminaries were so singular. A great fire was lit before the old fort, and while the tribe watched from a distance, all the virgins trooped out, giggling in their best dresses, and sat round it in a great circle. Then the drummers started as darkness fell, and presently out shuffled the dancers, young bucks and boys, dressed in the most fantastic costumes, capering about the flames. The only time, by the way, that I've ever seen Indians dancing round a fire in the approved style. First came the spirit seekers in coloured kilts with Aztec patterns and the long Apache leggings. They were all masked, and on their heads they bore peculiar frames decorated with coloured points and feathers and half-moons, which swayed as they danced and chanted. They were fully armed and shook their stone clubs and lances to drive away devils, while they asked God, Montezuma, I believe, for a blessing on Sonsierre, and presumably me. It was a slow, rhythmic, rather graceful dance, except for the little boys, whose task seemed to be to mock and tease the older men, which they did with great glee, to the delight of all. Then the drumming changed to a more hollow, urgent note, and all the girls jumped up in mock terror, staring about and cowering as out of the darkness raced the buffalo dancers, in coloured, fearsome masks surmounted by animal heads, scalps of bison and wolf and deer and mountain lion. As they leaped and whooped about the fire, all the virgins screamed and ran for their lives. But after a while, as the drumming grew faster and faster, they began to drift timidly back until they too were joining in the dance, circling and shuffling among the buffalo men in the fire glow. All very proper, mind you, no lascivious nonsense or anything like that. Then the drums stopped abruptly, the dance ceased, and the first spirit dancer took his stance before the fire and began to chant. The yawner tapped me on the shoulder. I was in my buckskins, by the way, with a garland round my neck, and he and another young brave called Quick Killer conducted me forward to stand before the spirit chief. We waited while he droned away, and presently out of the darkness comes Mangas, leading Sonsierre in a beautiful long white robe, all quilled and beaded, with her hair in two braids to her waist. She stood silent by me, and Mangas by the spirit chief, whose headdress barely topped the Mimbreno giant. Silence fell, and here's a strange thing. You know how my imagination works, and how at the hitching rail with Susie I reviewed my past alliances, Elspeth and Irma, and Madame Baboon of Madagascar? Well, this time I had no such visions. It may be that having Mangus Colorado looming over you, looking like something off the gutters of Notre Dame, concentrates the mind wonderfully. But also it didn't seem to be a very religious ceremony, somehow, and I didn't seem to have much part of it. What was said was in Apache, with no responses or anything for poor old Flash, although Sonsierre answered three or four times when the spirit chief addressed her, as did the yawner grunting at my elbow. I suppose he was my proxy, since I didn't speak the lingo. And while it's a nice thought in old age that Geronimo was your best man, well, there was something dashed perfunctory about the whole thing. I don't even know at what point we became man and wife, No clasp of hands or exchange of tokens or embracing the bride. Just a final wail from the spirit chief and a great yell from the assembly, and then off to the wedding feast. There, I admit, they do it in style. That feast lasted 3 days, all round the fire, stuffing down the sweet roasted agave leaves from the mescal pits, and baked meats, cornbread, chili, pumpkins, and all the rest, with vast quantities of a special wedding brew to wash it down. And you know, they don't let you near your bride in all that time. We sat on opposite sides of the fire in a great circle of relatives and friends, with the lesser mortals pressed behind. I suppose we must have left off feasting from time to time to sleep or relieve ourselves, but I swear I don't remember it. And she never looked in my direction once. Myself, I think they're damned cunning, the Apaches. You may know that in Turkey at wedding feasts they have a plump and voluptuous female who writhes about half naked in front of the groom to put him in trim for the wedding night. It's my belief that the Mimbreno are far subtler than that. Maybe there's something in the drink. Maybe it's the repetition of the dancing that goes on during the feast, with those bucks in their animal heads chasing, but never catching, the young females who flee continually, but never quite out of reach. Perhaps it's just the 3 days' delay in getting down to business. Whatever it may be, I found myself eyeing that white figure through the flames and starting to sweat something frightsome. I know she was no great beauty, not to compare with Elspeth or Lola or Cleone or the Silk One or Susie or Nariman or Fetnab or Lakshmi Bai or Lily Langtry or Vala or Cassie or Irma or the Empress Tsusi, or that big German wench off the Haymarket whose name escapes me. By Jove, I can't complain at the end of the day, can I? But by the time the third evening was reached, if you'd asked me my carnal ideal of womanhood, I'd have described it as just over 5 feet tall, sturdy and nimble, wearing a beaded tunic and white doe-skin leggings, with a round, chubby face, sulky lips, and great slanting black eyes that looked everywhere but at me. God, but she was pleased with herself, that smug, dumpy, nose-in-the-air wench. And I must have been about to burst when the yawner tapped me on the shoulder and jerked his head. And when I got up and panted my way out of the firelight, no one paid the least notice. Possibly I was drunk with liquor as well as lust, for I don't remember much except riding into the night with the yawner alongside and the shadowy form of Quick Killer ahead. The night wind did nothing to cool my ardour either, for it seemed to grow with each passing mile through the wooded hills, and by the time we dismounted, and they and the ponies had faded tactfully into the darkness, I could have tackled the entire fair sex, provided they were all short and muscular and apple-cheeked. Through the trees I could see the twinkle of a fire, and I blundered towards it, disrobing unsteadily, and staggering as I got my pants off. And there was the little wiki up, and no doubt the flowers were flapping about somewhere, but I didn't pause to look. She was reclining on a blanket at the door of the wiki up, on one elbow, that sturdy little brown body agleam in the fire glow, as though it had been oiled, and not a stitch on, except for the patterned headband above the cinnamon eyes that gleamed like hot coals, and the tight white leggings that came up to her hips. She didn't smile either, just gave me that sullen stare and stretched one leg while she stroked her hand down the seam of tiny bells, making them tinkle softly. My stars, I thought, it's been worth it, coming to America. And that's when I remember the pine needles under my knees and the smell of wood smoke and musk, and deliberately taking my time as I stroked and squeezed every inch of that hard, supple young body. For I was damned if I was going to give her the satisfaction of having me roar all over her like a wild bull. I'd been teased and sweated by her and her blasted tribal rituals too long for that. So I held off and played with her until the sulky pout left her lips and those glorious eyes opened wide as she forgot she was an Apache princess and became my trembling captive of the scalp hunter's camp again. and she began to gasp and squirm and reach out for me with little moans of querido and hoarse Apache endearments, which I'm sure from her actions were highly indelicate. And she suddenly flung herself up at me, grappling like a wrestler, and positively yowled as she clung with her arms round my neck and her bells pealing all over the place. "Now, that's a good little Indian maid," says I, and stopped her entreaties with my mouth, while I went to work in earnest, but very slowly, Susie fashion, which was a marvel of delightful self-restraint, and I'm sure did her a power of good. For as the warm dawn came up and I was drowsing happily under the blanket and deciding there were worse places to be than the Gila forest, there were those little lips at my ear and those hard breasts against me and the tiny whisper.
"Make my bells ring again, Pindalikoi."
So we rang the changes for breakfast. Chapter 13. There's nothing like teaching a new bride old tricks, and by the time our forest idyll was over, I flatter myself Sansiere was a happier and wiser woman. 10 days was enough of it, though, for she was an avid little beast who preferred quantity to quality, unlike Elspeth, for example, whose beguiling innocence masked the most lecherously inventive mind of the last century, and whose conduct on our honeymoon would have caused the good citizens of nearby Troon to burn her at the stake if they'd known. No, young Sansiere was more like Duchess Irma, who, on discovering a good thing, couldn't get enough of it. But where rogering had melted Irma's imperious nature to the point where she was prepared to await her lord's pleasure, my spirited Apache knew no such restraint. When she wanted her bells rung, she said so. She was tough, too, and discovered a great fondness for committing the capital act standing up under a waterfall in our stream. No wonder I've got rheumatism today. But it's worth it for the memory of that wet brown body lying back in my supporting arms, while the water cascaded down over her upturned face, with me grinding away up to my knees in the shallows. For the rest, she was an affectionate, cheerful little soul, so long as she got her own way, for she was damnably spoiled, and immensely vain of her Spanish blood, regarding the true-bred Mimbrenos with great condescension, even her terrible father. I remember the contempt with which she spoke of his habit of calling her by the pet name of Takes Away Clouds Woman, which she said was just what you might expect of a sentimental old savage, instead of by her proper name, Morning Star, which she thought much more fitting for an Apache princess. "But it suits you," says I, stroking away at her leggings. "You take away my clouds, I can tell you. Besides, I like your fanciful Indian names. What's mine, by the way, apart from White Eye?"
"Don't you know why ever since you rode with your lance at the pegs, everyone calls you by a fine name? White Rider goes so fast he destroys the wind with his speed."
It sounded not bad, if a bit of a mouthful. "They can't call me all that every time," says I.
"Of course not, foolish one. They shorten it. He who breaks the wind, or just windbreaker."
She was in dead earnest, too.
"Why, don't you like it?"
"Couldn't be better," says I. "Just my luck to get one of their names that contracts to something frightful when translated. I knew an old Glala once whose full name was Brave Pursues Enemies So Fiercely He Has No Time to Change His Clothes, that came out as Stinking Drawers. And I can give you chapter and verse if you doubt it. I said I'd rather she chose me a pet name."
"Let me think," says she, nestling. "A name. You should win it by some great and wonderful deed."
She giggled, and her hand strayed mischievously.
"I know. It should be, Man Who Rings Her Bells Makes Her Heart Melt."
Her mouth trembled, and her lids narrowed.
"Ah, yes. Win your new name, please. Now, Windbreaker."
I reckon I did, too, so far as she was concerned. But the yawner was still calling me Windbreaker last year. Damn him. Sansiere and I returned to the copper mines just as the community was moving into winter quarters in the hills. And if you wonder why I hadn't taken advantage of our solitary state on honeymoon to make a break for freedom, well, I still didn't know where I was, even. And although we'd been undisturbed, I'd had a shrewd idea that the yawner and quick killer were never far away. Now, to make matters worse, the tribe moved about 30 miles southwest, farther than ever from the Del Norte and safety, into a mountainous forest, where if I'd been fool enough to run, I'd have been lost and recaptured in no time. So, there was nothing for it but to settle down, with a heavy heart, and wait through those awful months, telling myself that the chance of escape must come in the spring. When I thought back to the snug billet I'd abandoned at Susie's in Santa Fe, and the foul luck that had led me to Gallantin in this nightmare, I could have wept. But at least I was still whole, and no worse off than I'd been in Madagascar, and I'd got out of that in the end. Now, as then, I forced myself to remember that there was a world outside this stinking collection of native huts and Neolithic brutes. A world with Elspeth in it, and white faces, and beds and houses, and clean linen, and honest food and drink, and civilized whores. I must just wait and watch, keep my Arab up to strength, learn everything I could, and when the time came, ride like the devil, leaving the latest Mrs. Flashman and her charming relatives forever. The more I saw of them that winter, the more I grew to detest them, in case you suppose from the recent tender passages that marriage and kinship had made me at all soft on Apaches. Let me put you right. I became fairly well acquainted with Mangus Colorado, perforce, and quite friendly with the Yawner, while Sancierre was a charming and energetic bedmate. But they were monsters, all of them, and I include my dear little wife. Loving and even captivating she could be with her pretty ways and fluent Spanish, and a few civilized habits, like washing regularly, picked up from her unfortunate mother. But at heart she was as vicious and degraded an Apache as any of them. I shan't forget the night when she was snuggled up telling me Indian legends, like the boy who could not go west. And some reference to a villain's sticky end reminded her of the fate of those members of Galantine's band who'd been taken prisoner. There'd been 15 of them, and the Mimbreno ladies' sewing circle had held a contest to see who could keep a victim alive longest under torture. The other women's patients, Sancierre told me proudly, had all expired after a few hours. But she'd kept that poor devil Ilario lingering in unspeakable agony for 2 solid days. She described it in gruesome detail, chuckling drowsily, while I lay listening with the sweat icy on my skin. Having known Nariman and good Queen Ranavalona and Gezo's Amazons, I had no illusions about the fair sex's talent for tickling up the helpless male. But this was the sweet child of 16 whom I'd married and sported with in sylvan glades like Phyllis and Corydon. I tupped her with no great ardour that night, I can tell you. But it was of a piece with all that I knew and was still to learn that winter of the Apache. They truly enjoy cruelty for its own sake. And incidentally, they are a living contradiction of the old fable, although it happens to be true in my own case, that a bully who delights in inflicting pain is invariably a coward. For if they have a virtue, in most folks' eyes anyway, it is courage. You never saw a scared Apache yet. It's been their downfall. Unlike the other tribes, they never knew when to quit against the pony soldiers. My old pal Yawner fought on until there was only a tattered remnant of his band left to be herded onto the reservation, which, be it noted, was more mercy than ever he'd shown to a beaten foe. If Apache custom had been applied to the Pash, there wouldn't be one left. They knew how to fight, too, after their fashion, far better than the Plains tribes. Given numbers, they might be holding out in Arizona yet, for bar the Patans, they were the best guerrillas ever I saw. They trained their boys from infancy in every art of woodcraft and ambush and decoy. And theft, which is the way they love to make war, rather than in open battle. At winter, in the Gila Hills, I saw lads of 6 and 7 made to run up and down mountains, lie doggo for hours, spend nights half naked in the snow, track each other through the brush, run off horses, and exercise constantly with club and knife, axe and lance, sling and bow. Damn good they are, too. But best of all, they could vanish into thin air. The Yawner himself showed me this one day when I admired his skill in stalking a deer. He said it was nothing, and if I wanted to see how good he was, let me turn my back and count my fingers 10 times. So I did, and when I looked around, the little bastard had simply disappeared. This on a bare plain, without a scrap of cover for 1/2 mile. He absolutely wasn't there, until he stood up at my elbow with his huge gaping grin and showed me the shallow trench he'd scraped in silence and in less than 2 minutes, within a few yards of me. He'd pulled tufts of grass and earth over his body, and although I'd looked directly at the spot, I'd seen nothing. No one ever believes that story, but I watched as many as 20 pash at a time vanish in that way, and there are U.S. Army scouts who'll vouch for it. It's one of the first lessons they teach their boys. It was after seeing it that I began to suspect that they might give the Yanks a run for their money. And they did, didn't they? Apart from these warlike activities, I learned many curious things about them that winter, their love of sports, such as running and swimming, horse racing, and shooting or throwing lances at rolling hoops. The women have a game much like hockey, at which Sancerre excelled. But the great pastime is dice, for all Apaches are inveterate gamblers. They're also highly superstitious. An Apache will never speak his name. I'm told the Chiricahua never speak to their mothers-in-law either, sensible chaps. Or hunt a bear, and they think rattlesnakes are inhabited by lost souls. They regard fish as unclean meat, never drink milk, can't multiply or divide, although some of them can count higher than any other Indians I met, and speak a language which I never mastered. That was partly because most of them spoke Spanish, more or less, but also because it's damned complicated, with 5 times as many vowel sounds as we have. And the Pash, unlike most Indians, are the worst mutterers you ever heard, and 19 to the dozen at that. But the main reason I never learned Apache was that I disliked them and everything about them too much to want to. From all this you'll gather that it was a damn long winter, and made no easier by the fact that a male Apache does nothing in all that time, except a little light hunting. For the rest he loafs, eats, sleeps, drinks, and thinks up devilment for the spring. So that in addition to being miserable and fearful, I was also bored. When you find yourself glad even of Mangus Colorado to talk to, by God, you're in a bad way. The only worthwhile amusement was teaching Sancerre new positions, for there was no question of so much as looking at another female, even if I dared or wanted to. They're fearfully hot against adultery, you see, and punish it by clipping the errant female's nose off. What they do to the man, I was careful not to inquire. But one thing that interminable season of waiting certainly did accomplish. They got used to me, and by the time the snow melted in the lower valleys, I doubt if it occurred, even to the shrewd, suspicious Mangus, that I might be preparing to slip my cable. I'd been a model, if reserved, son-in-law. Sancerre was clearly infatuated, and what Pinda Licoyi, honoured by admission to the Mimbreno and marriage to the Morning Star, would be so half-witted as to want to return to his own people. At any rate, when the first big war party was formed to open the season with a descent on the Del Norte, it was simply assumed that I would take my part. Mangas even returned to me the revolver I'd lost when I was captured. And Sancerre herself painted the white stripe across my nose from ear to ear, and gloated at the thought of the booty I'd bring home. Jewelry was what she wanted, but silk or lace would be acceptable too, and a couple of Mexican boys as domestic slaves. I can't think why she didn't ask for girls.
"And some new bells for my moccasins," says she with that slow, pouting smile that was the only thing that had made life endurable through that awful winter. "To make her heart melt."
Do you know, it was ridiculous, but as I took my arm from round her waist, mounted the Arab, and looked down into those lovely cinnamon eyes for what I hoped to God would be the last time, I felt a pang. There were great tears in them, and I don't care. It may be as hellish a place as that camp was, with those painted ape men jabbering as they swung aboard their ponies, the women clustered round the hovels, the place foul and stinking with the winter's filth, the dogs yapping among the piles of refuse, the acrid smoke of the morning fires catching at your throat, and the horror of that captivity burned into your mind. But when your woman sees you away and cries over your departure, and reaches up to catch your hand and press it to her cheek, and you look back and see the little white figure among the pines waving you out of sight, well, I thought, I've ridden worse, waterfalls or not, and the next buck that gets you is going to be a lucky man, for you're the best trained red rump in North America. There were perhaps 100 of us setting out from the hill camp that day, including all the principal men of the tribe. Mangus himself, Delgadito, Black Knife, Iron Eyes, Ponce, the Yawner, and Quick Killer. Every horse in the valley had been pressed into service, for the Apaches were by no means so flush of horse flesh then as they became later. And about a quarter of our command were afoot. The medicine men inspected us to make sure we had our talismans and medicine cords, and that the younger fellows had their scratching tubes. Then they threw pollen at the sun, chanting, and off we went, in five groups as we left the hills, which is the Apache style on the warpath, the separate bands scouring the country and converging on the main objective. My heart leaped as I heard Mangas shouting in their dialect to the infantry groups, as they branched off northeast across the plain, and I caught the name Fra Cristobal. For that lay north on the Del Norte, not far south of Socorro, and if I couldn't win to safety between here and there, well, there would be something far wrong. Needless to say, there was. From the hills, our five groups fanned out across the mesa, which stretched away endlessly towards the east. I was in the center group with Mangus and Delgadito. I wasn't sorry that the Yawner and Quick Killer went with one of the southeast bands, for they were the last chaps I wanted on my tail when the time came to cut stick. We rode due east, with the sun like a pale luminous ball in the misty morning, and made good time at a brisk trot. We must have covered 40 miles that first day, and I was pleased that my Arab showed no signs of fatigue. We saw not a living soul on the plain, but in mid-afternoon I had the shock of my life, for ahead of us on the horizon there came into view the outline of what could only be a city, and such a city as I couldn't believe existed in this wilderness. Great buildings reared up out of the mesa, in symmetrical array, brown adobe by the look of them, but far larger than anything even in Santa Fe. It was bewildering, but my companions paid no heed to it, riding on in their usual sullen silence on either side of me. And it was only when we got to within a mile or so that I realized these weren't buildings at all, but enormous square and oblong rocks, for all the world as though some giant had set them down like a child's building bricks in the middle of nowhere. We passed within half a mile of them, and they looked so neatly arranged, and reminded me so much of an enormous Stonehenge, but I suppose they must be the work of some savage sun worshippers, though how they transported those massive stones I couldn't image. We camped that night in a shallow river bottom filled with cottonwoods, and rode on next day through broken country, which began to incline slowly downwards. My excitement rose, for I guessed we must be approaching the Del Norte Valley. Sure enough, in the late afternoon, we came out of low hills, and there below us in the fading light of sunset lay the familiar fringe of cottonwoods, with here and there a gleam of water amongst them, and low, scraggy bluffs beyond. Just over the river smoke was rising from a fair-sized village, all peaceful in the last rays of the afternoon sun. As we dismounted, my heart was thumping fit to burst, as I realized that if this was our quarry, I'd never get a better chance to break. We were in a little gully, and while we stripped off our shirts and oiled ourselves and renewed our paint,
It's mad, isn't it, a civilized white man decorating himself like a savage? But after 6 months among these beasts, I never thought twice about it. Mangus told Delgadito what was to be done. We would ford the river with the last of the light, descend on the village, burn and pillage it, especially of any horses and mules it might contain, and withdraw to our present position for the night. We didn't want prisoners, since tomorrow we would be riding north, wiping up any small settlements that lay in our path along the river, making for the rendezvous where we would meet the walking bands. Mangus was not to lead us against the village in person. In many ways he was a man after my own heart, for he never ventured his skin unless he had to. But no one thought twice about it, his valour was so well established. And how many civilized generals do you know who scrimmage alongside their soldiery? While Delgadito, a slim, evil-faced villain who looked more Spaniard than Apache, gave us our tactical directions. Mangus loafed among us, inspecting. I can still see that huge, stooped, untidy figure in the gloaming as he stopped before me. The black eyes glinting beneath his hat brim, and feel his coarse thumb as he wiped a smear of paint from my cheek and patted my shoulder, and smell the rank odor that I associate forever with the word Apache. Softly across the ford, then scatter and ride straight in, growls Delgadito. First kill, then plunder, then burn. All except Iron Eyes, Windbreaker, and Cavallo, who ride round for the far side and secure the corral. Very neat and professional, thinks I. Right, Mimbreno, let's go. I've ridden in some odd company in my time. Light Brigade at Balaclava, Ildurim's Patani regulars, Yakub Beg's Kokand Horde under Fort Rhyme, to say nothing of Custer and that maniac J.E.B. Stewart. But that descent of the Apaches across the Del Norte must have been the strangest of all. Picture, if you will, that score of primitives with their painted faces and headbands and ragged kilts and boots, fairly bristling with lances and hatchets, and in their midst the tall figure of the English gentleman, flower of the 11th Hussars, with the white stripe across his face, his hair rank to his shoulders, his buckskin stinking to rival the Fleet Ditch. Lance in fist and knife on hip. You'd never think he'd played at Lord's, or chatted with the Queen, or been rebuked by Dr. Arnold for dirty fingernails. Well, yes, you might. Or been congratulated by my Lord Cardigan on his brilliant turnout. Oh, freshman rides uncommon well, don't he, Jones? And there was his pride and joy, as foul an aborigine as any of them, picking his way through the shallows and sand flats, and breaking with a whoop and a scream, as the first yell of alarm rose from the village, the shots rang out, and the savage band charged into the mass of huts, with Delgadito at their head. I swerved after Iron Eyes under the cottonwoods behind the village, and my eyes were already straining ahead towards the low bluffs beyond.